So yesterday we started discussing this prototype of a classical field theory, which is the Maxwell's electromagnetism. And the theory is so beautiful and a prototype for everything is that let me just use today the opportunity to discuss, you know, some more things about Maxwell's theory and to have more fun about Maxwell's theory. And so as any classical field theory, the theory consists of two sets of equations. So first, you have the field equations due to Maxwell in 1860. These are these four beautiful equations here. And they basically tell you, given the sources, given the currents, and given the distribution of the charges, you know, what are the electric fields E and B here? So I can find the electric fields E and B from these equations. But there's another set of equations, which is like, if I already find E and B, what is the corresponding motion of the matter, of the charged particles? And that's provided to you by Lorentz force law. Of course, I'm always confused which Lorentz is without T. And so yesterday I made a wrong choice. Sorry for that. So this one, the force law is actually with T. but today you will see Lorentz gauge condition, which will be without T. So sorry for that. So what we discussed about these is that actually, you know, until 1860, basically everything was there, although it was not written in this form, and it was basically the partial differential equations were not invented then. But anyway, so this term was missing, and it's the Maxwell's current. So if you put it on the right-hand side, you can think about it as a current. Of course, it doesn't make sense to put it on the right-hand side. It's rather an operator acting on your electric field. But anyway, this piece was missing. And as a consequence, you had an independent constraint on your charges, which was the continuity equation. However, that was strange. And so Maxwell decided, I actually include this term. And once you do that, we've seen yesterday that the continuity equation follows from these equations simply as a consistency check. So it follows from these equations. It's a consistency equation which you can get from Maxwell's equations. So it's no longer an independent statement, but it follows from Maxwell's equations. Similarly, we shall see in general relativity that consistency condition or consistency equations for the Einstein equations is something really interesting. It's more than a continuity equation. We will see that's actually equation of motion. So in other words, this thing here in general relativity will basically follow from Einstein equations. And that's why general relativity is really special. And we will see this very explicitly. But anyway, so here, all we get is the continuity equation. And of course, this is something like a charge conservation, provided that there is no flux of current through our boundary. I also briefly discussed that you should be viewing these equations as basically six evolution equations, despite that you have eight equations. Two scalar equations are not true evolution equations. Well, it's obvious they don't have any d over dt here. So they must be something like constraints or initial data or something like that. So only these two here are the true evolution equations. And these sort of provide some constraints which have to be satisfied. And beauty of this thing is that if you satisfy these constraints at one instant of time, let's say at the Big Bang, you create the universe with no magnetic monopoles, but with some electric charges, then these constraints will be satisfied all the time, provided these two equations are satisfied. Okay, so that's what is beautiful about this. And of course, constraints have to be satisfied in all times. We know that from classical mechanics. All right. So there's another way how we can write these equations. So this is the general relativity way. You write a differential operator acting on the field, E and B, is equal to the sources. That's precisely how we will write Einstein equations. We will have some differential operator acting on gravitational field on the metric equals to the sources, which is the energy momentum tensor. Okay. So you can also, however, write it So mathematicians doing, you know, evolution equations will write it always as d over dt equals to the rest. And so then I have an evolution form. Okay. Okay. So now let's have some fun with these equations. And let's look at this miracle here, 1860, more closely. And so we'll discuss Maxwell's triumph. And so he included this term. He realized that, you know, continuity equation follows from Maxwell equations. So that's first triumph he had. However, once he included this term, he also looked at what happens with these equations if there are no sources. So if no sources, so people would typically assume, or you know, from electrostatics, you know that if there are no charges present, then there's no field. Okay, so what you would expect is that if no sources, you know, E and B should be trivial. But so let's look at what happens here. And the statement if no sources, field can still be non-trivial. Which was like a miraculous finding. And so how do we do that? So let's look at, we are setting now the current J equal to zero and the charge density equal to zero. Let's take this equation here and let's apply a curl on it. So now we will be using a miracle set identity, vector identity. So we have an identity that a curl of any vector can be written as a gradient of divergence of that vector minus a Laplace operator on that vector. So Laplace is just divergence of gradient, if you want. So, or Laplace square, sometimes people write. So there's this beautiful differential vector identity. And so let's apply it. So let's take equation 2. So, and let's apply curl on this equation 2. So what do we get? So we have curl of E. So by this thing is gradient. So we have gradient divergence of E minus Laplace on E. And then we have minus dB over dt, and then there's a curl of B equals to zero. Okay, so this is what happens when you apply a curl on equation number 2. And again, I swap the derivative, time derivative with the spatial derivatives. All right, so now we can use equation number 3, but there are no sources now, so divergence of E is equal to zero from equation 3. And curl of B from equation 1 is just dE over dt. That's the term which was missing. So this thing here is dE over dt from equation 1. Why am I getting the wrong sign?
Because you don't understand.
Sorry?
No,
there's a plus. Oh, thank you so much. That saves everything. Okay. So there's a plus here because there was a plus there. So now we are getting a beautiful equation. Is that, Laplace minus d square over dt square acting on E equals to zero. Or, of course, this is dimensionally incorrect. I have spatial derivatives, I have time derivatives. That's the choice because of the Gauss units. So what really should be standing here is 1 over some velocity. Okay, so let's introduce a box operator, which will be minus 1 over velocity d square over dt square plus the Laplace operator. Okay, so let's define this. Let's call it a wave operator. Wave operator. And of course, you know, that would describe waves, the solution. If you have wave operator acting on something, that will describe waves which propagate at a speed c. So waves, so c is the speed of propagation of these speed of propagation of these waves. Okay, so then we found that we have the box operator acting on e equals to zero with, in our units, c equal to 1. Okay? So in other words, you can still have non-trivial solutions for your electric field, even in the absence of sources. You will have wave-like solutions, and these waves will propagate at the speed c equals to 1. Okay? So that's amazing. So, of course, the same thing works for B. So now we have to take, we would have to take curl of the other equation. Well, let's not bother. Okay, so similarly, you would find, we would find that B also satisfies the same wave equation. Okay, so another truth is that even if in the absence of sources, we can still have non-trivial E's and B's. So actually, they live on their own. They are their own physical entities. They are not necessarily bound to your charges, right? They can just propagate through empty space on their own, and they behave like waves. So we discovery of electromagnetic waves, which are not bound to the charges at all. Okay, so that's the second triumph. But it's actually much better than that, because you see that from this derivation here, what follows is that your waves propagate at the speed c. Okay, and so, of course, in our Gauss units, the c is just 1. But in practice, if you use other units, you can actually really predict the speed of light. So better. These waves propagate at the speed of light. So in our unit, c equal to 1. But which was surprise, and you know, it was so amazing. So of course, people knew at the time, and in 1860, they already knew, you know, the speed of light. They already measured that, and so Maxwell calculated, you know, this predicted speed for these waves, and realized this is precisely that. And so then he says, well, now I know what light is. It's just an electromagnetic wave. Okay, so light is just an electromagnetic wave. And so he immediately unified two completely separate disciplines. So he unified the theory of electromagnetism, which was, you know, studied by these people, and the theory of light, which was studied by these people, and there was no overlap whatsoever. So unification of electromagnetism, let's be very crude, with optics. Okay, whatever, with the theory of light. And so this is so amazing that, you know, he was awarded a chair in Cambridge. So he came to Cambridge, and as always happens to people who come to Cambridge, you are overwhelmed with the environment, and you don't do any work later. Okay? So basically he came to Cambridge and he drank himself to death, and then that was okay. But as we shall see, it's even actually something much more fundamental than unification of electromagnetism with optics. But there's another conclusion here, is that we predicted one absolute speed, the speed of light. Okay? But the very existence of an absolute speed is contradictory to Galilean transformations. You know that the velocities, yes?
How did he, so in our unit C is 1, how did he calculate the speed?
Oh, the C depends on these constants epsilon 0 and mu 0, and they were measured
4.
From electromagnetic phenomena. And so then, you know, this is something like square root of mu 0 epsilon 0 or something like that. So he knew what these constants were, and he calculated that C comes to be that. And so he can calculate from this constant and measure this like 3,000, whatever. And then he compared this the speed of light. Yeah. So this was measured.
So at that point, people already knew that light traveled at a finite speed. I mean, already.
Of course, they knew then. Yeah. It was known. Yeah. So the very existence. Of absolute speed in vacuum contradicts Newton, contradicts Galilean transformations and Newton physics. So Maxwell equations, they don't have invariance with respect to the Galilean transformations. Rather, they have invariance with respect to other transformations, the Lorentz transformations. And so, you know, this is the origin of special relativity. And this is how Einstein arrived at special relativity. He was asking a question, you know, if the velocities are relative, can I actually speed up so much that I can see an electromagnetic wave standing in front of me instead of passing me by at the speed of light? That was his question. Can I actually go to that speed so that I see it standing? And then he answered, no, I can't do that. As long as I am an observer, physical observer, I always see light passing me by at the speed of light, no matter how fast I move. Okay, and so that was his way towards special relativity. So interestingly, people knew that, you know, in 1905, they knew that already, you know, Lorentz transformations and Lorentz knew many things, but he couldn't, you know, make a new principle. And Einstein said, well, I can never catch the light, and that's my principle. He elevated to that fundamental principle of physics, and then he arrived at special relativity. So it took 40 years. It took 45 years to realize that. But Einstein did by studying Maxwell equations. So 1905, and we will do that way tomorrow. All right, so this is truly amazing year for physics. And so we have special relativity coming from here. Are there any questions? So when you would ask people who is like a prototype of a theoretical physicist, well, they probably know Einstein. So they would say Einstein, but I would say Maxwell would be equally high as Einstein because he did these things here. All right. So now let's discuss something else. Let's discuss electromagnetic potentials. So I told you at the beginning that Maxwell's theory is a gauge theory, but there's no gauges here. There's no freedom in description. We just have electric field E, magnetic field B. So why is it a gauge theory? So let's discuss electromagnetic potentials. And the answer is that, you know, you shouldn't be thinking about E and B fields, really the gauge fields, the fundamental fields. Rather, the fundamental fields will be these electromagnetic potentials, phi and A. And they will have some gauge freedom. But from a classical point of view, phi and A are really just, you know, a mathematical convenience. They don't have any physical meaning. E and B, they have physical meaning. They enter the force law and so on. But from a quantum mechanical perspective, you know, Aharonov-Bohm effect and stuff like that. So you can have, you know, fields equal to zero, but still potentials do affect physics. Okay, so classically, okay, these are just mathematical convenience. But at quantum level, quantum theory, they actually have physical meaning. All right, so what these potentials are. So now you have these four equations here, and you basically want to eliminate those without sources. So you want to eliminate equation number two and equation number four. By using some vector identities, you want to automatically satisfy them. So let's start with four. So we know the divergence of B equals to zero. So can we actually choose B so that this equation is automatically satisfied? And we can be using the identity, the divergence of curl of vector is identically equal to zero. And we'll be using an identity that curl, what is it, of gradient of a function is also identically equal to zero. So these are the two identities which we'll be using. We have been using them yesterday as well. So take equation four, and we want to satisfy it, satisfy automatically. And so we want to use this thing. So if we set B equal to curl of some vector, then this will be true. So that vector is called A and it's called vector potential. So then this, if you make this definition here, this equation will be automatically satisfied. All right, so that's great. So we traded B for A, so we feed it three quantities for another three quantities. That's good. So now let's look at equation two. So the equation two now is curl of E plus dB over dT, so plus d over dT curl of A equals to zero. Okay, so now I swap these things and I shouldn't have. Anyway, so now I can write it as curl of E plus dA over dT equals to zero. So that's our second equation. And now if I look at this identity here, then you see that you can automatically satisfy that by setting the bracket equal to a gradient of some function. So using the other identity, I can just set this to be, and the convention is a minus gradient of a function phi. Okay, so then if you want, I can write E as minus gradient of phi minus dA over dT. And that automatically satisfies equation number two. Okay? So we, by just doing mathematical tricks, we introduce instead of E and B, so we went from E and B, which were six quantities, to quantities phi and A. Phi is a scalar, A is a vector, so we have just four quantities. Okay, so that's a useful mathematical trick, right? So you go from six to four, it's perfect. You've eliminated two equations, equation four and equation two. So you have now only one and three to deal with. So that's really, really convenient. Okay. It's actually better than that, because once you have these quantities phi and A, you realize that I can change phi and A in a certain way, but still E and B will remain the same. So there's still a freedom. So there's a gauge freedom. There is a gauge freedom. And the statement is, if I change phi to phi minus d lambda over dt and change a at the same time to a plus gradient of lambda, where lambda is an arbitrary function, then E and B do not change. So this is a gauge function. It is a scale function. Okay, so let's look at that. So for example, let's look at B. So we have kel of A. So B is kel of A. So now I'm saying it's kel of A plus curl of gradient of lambda, but curl of gradient is zero. So that's why this thing does not change B. So similarly, I can take E. Okay, so it's minus gradient of phi. Let's see. Okay, so E prime now is minus gradient of phi, but phi is minus d lambda over dt, and then minus dA over dt minus d over dt gradient of lambda. Okay, so that's how my E looks like after I do this gauge transformation. All right, so we have minus gradient of phi minus dA over dt, which is the original E. And then we have plus gradient d lambda over dt minus, and I can swap these, gradient d lambda over dt. So these terms cancel, and then you really have the original E. So E and B do not change under these things. Okay, so I have this gauge freedom here, and it's encoded in an arbitrary scalar gauge function. Okay, so that's great. So in particular, no matter if you have sources or not, you can impose some interesting gauges, meaning you can impose some constraints on what these phi and a can satisfy. And I will leave that up to you to show that in particular, you can impose some gauge conditions, meaning you're fixing this gauge, you're fixing this freedom here. You're exploiting your freedom in lambda to set something. And so particularly useful is the Lorentz gauge. So now without T, can impose Lorentz gauge, and that's simply d phi over dt plus divergence of A equals to zero. So in other words, I can always find such phi and A so that this is satisfied. And this is with or without sources, or without. So even if I have currents and charges and so on, you can always choose a gauge so that this is true.
I'm not sure to see why this makes that we fix the lambda function, for example. If we...
Oh, so you're asking how this is done? Or...
What?
No, I'm saying, you know, I can always, for whatever lambda I choose, I can find a new A and new phi, and it doesn't matter what these are, you know, the E and B will remain untouched. That's the statement.
Yeah, but the Lorentz gauge.
Okay.
Then we can choose another. We can choose lambda that verify the wave function.
So basically, the statement is: I start with some phi and a, and I calculate this left-hand side, and I find that it's not equal to zero; that it's equal to something. So now I make a gauge transformation on phi and a. And so this will now depend on lambda, okay? And it's still equal to, you know, something. So now the question is, can I choose such a lambda so that I kill the right-hand side, okay? And the answer is yes. It's just, you know, the lambda will satisfy some equation which always has a solution. So I can always find such lambda so that this is true. So that's how you would prove it?
The solution is not unique. So
What do you mean?
The lambda we can choose is not always unique. We can have different lambda, so we have different phi.
But it doesn't matter, right? So okay, if you have sources, the statement is it's almost unique. But anyway, so as long as I can find such lambdas that this is true, we are fine. And so the beauty of this is that I can always do this, even if I have sources. What is more non-trivial to show is that if you are in vacuum, so if no sources, you can show that there is still a residual gauge freedom. So gauge is not completely fixed yet. In fact, there's lots of lambdas which actually satisfy this equation. And I can use, you know, this freedom in these lambdas to do something more. I can impose one more condition. So can impose one more condition, more gauge condition. And of course, as a result, so look at this. So we started with E and B, which were six quantities. Okay. Then by a clever mathematical trick, we went to four quantities, phi and a. Okay, so then the statement is, this is still overdetermined, so we can always do this Lorentz gauge condition. So we can actually, this is one equation, so there's 4 minus 1, we have now 3 degrees of freedom. But if we are in vacuum, and there's one more. So in vacuum, we have 4 minus 1 minus 1, which is 2 degrees of freedom. And these will precisely correspond to two polarizations of electromagnetic waves at the classical level. So two polarizations. Of EM waves. Or at the quantum level, it corresponds to two polarizations of the photon.
Sorry, when we say that we have 4 degrees of freedom, are we saying that the magnetic field B and electric field E are not independent?
They are not?
Independent, I say.
So now we made a shift, right? So we started with the fact that we treated E and B as the fundamental fields. Uh-huh. But then we showed actually that's not true. I can go to 4 fields and they contain all the information, right? I can, if I know A and phi, I can always recover E and B. Okay, so then actually the true fields are phi and A. Right? So there's less of them, and you know, once I know them, I can recover E and B. So very good. So now I have 4, but now I can do actually 2 gauge fixings. And so I'm just down to 2. So this is, but that's only in vacuum. Okay. Other questions?
Sorry, I'm saying that if they are not independent, can we construct like some constraint functions?
So for example, if you have electromagnetic wave, you know that E and B have to be perpendicular. So for example, E times B equals to 0, that gives you one scalar equation, which is a constraint between E and B, for example.
Sorry, why we choose that gauge? I mean,
we can do it.
Are we going to have like...
We will use this gauge to show some... So, okay. So we eliminated 2 and 4, and we are still left with 1 and 3. So this Lorentz gauge is super useful when dealing with 1 and 3. Okay, so we will...
So it is supposed that when we have gauge freedom, all the states that are in the same gauge orbit are all of them physically related. So if we get another... gauge condition, are we going to have like the same physics, or?
Well, you can fix the gauge whatever you know. Another useful gauge would be like consider the separately. So for example, divergence of A equals to 0. That's another gauge.
So okay. Like a mathematical.
It's just a mathematical trick. Of course, you know, by fixing the gauge, I'm not really doing anything to the physics, right? I'm just trying to extract physics in particular gauge, like choosing one concrete lambda. When we discuss the constraints.
They are like more constraints, right? Like when you fix the gauge, it's just like adding one more constraint.
Well, if you fix the gauge, what do you mean you need one more constraint?
Yeah, because fixing the gauge is a new condition, and it's just like a new constraint.
Sure. No, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So it's, I'm really putting, yeah,
but
that's right.
Constraints are not related with something physical, because I've been working with these things and I always, I didn't know how to choose the gauge.
Okay.
And I don't know if it is related to physics, like just fixing the gauge, like the constraint that we get.
Well, so it's the same thing we were doing with the pendulum, right? So you can either describe it by eliminating constraints at the beginning, or I can treat it with constraints and, you know, enlarge my phase space, and then I can fix the constraint when I want. And so that's what we are doing here. The statement is there is only two degrees of freedom in the theory, and so everything else is just overdoing in our description, right? So we chose a description in terms of phi and a, which is four quantities, but we just overdid it. So that's just too much. That's not the physical content of the theory. It's only two which are physical. And so how you fix the gauge, it doesn't really matter. In the end, the description will be independent of the gauge, sort of.
Yeah.
OK. So in a vacuum, we have two polarizations of electromagnetic waves. Let me just use the opportunity here to tell you some beautiful statement about the gauge theories and about the 2 degrees of freedom. And if you don't remember anything from the course, just please remember this statement. It's particularly useful for your future and for everything. So statement, which I will not prove, statement is that in any gauge theory, if you want to calculate how many 2 degrees of freedom are there, if you have free field, so number of 2 degrees of freedom equals to the number of apparent degrees of freedom minus 2 times the size of the gauge function, so degrees of freedom of a gauge function. Okay, and this is beautiful counting which you can do, and it will be true in any gauge theory. So when you discuss gravity, this will be true. When you will discuss some higher p forms in string theory, that will be true, and so on. So this is extremely useful thing. So what I mean by this, okay, so in electromagnetism, we just saw this working. So we had the fields were phi and a. So there were 4 fields. So apparently, we have 4. So this is the apparent number of degrees of freedom, because we use for our description fields phi and a, and there's 4 of them. So we have 4 apparent degrees of freedom. But then we have a gauge function. So then we have lambda, which is the gauge function, and it's a scalar function. So there's 1 degree of freedom. So 1 degree of freedom in a scalar. So then if you want how many true polarizations the field will classically have in vacuum is so true degrees of freedom is simply 4. Minus 2 times 1. I can use the gauge function twice. So this 2 is miracles 2. It tells you I can always use the degree of the gauge function twice to kill 2 degrees of, well, each, yeah, which is 2 polarizations of the photon. Okay, so that's the photon polarizations. Okay, so this is how you arrive at this. So just demonstrate for you, if you know how the gravity works. Gravity, we have, so gravity, gravitational field is described by, just a second, by a metric. So g mu nu is the field. A metric is a 4x4 symmetric matrix. 4x4 symmetric matrix. If you can think about it this way. So now how many degrees of free? So okay. So index mu and nu, they run from 0 to 3. So 4x4. How many apparent degrees of freedom do we have?
10?
10, exactly. So if we had just 4 by 4 matrix, we would have 16. But because it has to be symmetric, it's minus 6, so it's 10. So 10 apparent degrees of freedom. OK, so then similar to electromagnetism, there is something which leaves the field strength invariant, and which sort of corresponds to gauge transformations. So you can go from g mu nu to g mu nu plus nabla mu xi nu plus nabla nu xi mu. OK, so whatever the nabla is some kind of derivative, not important. But xi nu is the gauge function. So it's a gauge function. And it is a vector. So it has four components. Four component vector. OK. All right, so what it means is by our formula here is that the number of true degrees of freedom is equal to 10 minus 2 times 4, which gives you again 2. And these correspond to two polarizations of gravitational waves, two polarizations of gravitational waves, or two polarizations of the graviton. OK, so this works beautifully for any gauge theory. So then when you discuss your string theory course, we'll have some interesting gauge fields. So try to apply this wonderful formula there as well to calculate the degrees of freedom there. Yes?
What is the intuition?
Simply the intuition is that every gauge degree of freedom I have, I can use twice. OK, that seems strange, but you can. we will see this explicitly on examples. So you will actually show this explicitly for gravity. Very nice way how to do it is in light cone gauge in the K space, in the Fourier space, where you can really see how your equations of motion, you know, sort of split into something which you can gauge away by really choosing these xi's to be something. So I choose xi's to be something. It kills my components of the metric and of the equations, and you just end up with 2 degrees of freedom. So you will see that explicitly for gravity. I don't know how the proof in general goes. I've seen it in some old field theory book, which I don't remember what it was, but it's true. OK. Yeah?
Why do we have the 2 in the statement?
Do we have what?
The 2.
The 2, yeah. Yes. We do. So in the same way as, for example, when we are discussing the integrability of the Hamiltonian systems, right? So we had n degrees of freedom, which means our phase space was 2n dimensional. And our solution would depend on 2n integration constants, right? But in order to integrate this, all we needed was just n integrals of motion in involution. What it means is that basically, practically, you can use each integral twice to get rid of the degrees of freedom. This is the same thing. OK, so that didn't really answer the question, but the truth is, yeah, 2 is an important number. And you know, you can do it explicitly in electromagnetism. You can show that you can impose the Lorentz gauge condition. But you can show that if you are in vacuum, you still have extra degrees of freedom. You can still have some gauge freedom. And you can show that I can solve another equation and impose another constraint. OK. But only in vacuum. You know that if you have medium, if you have charges and currents and whatever, then actually you have 3 polarizations. OK. So you have only 2 polarizations if you are in vacuum. All right, so that was an exposure to field theory. So now we still need to deal with equation 1 and 3. So let's deal with 1 and 3. So let me start with three. It looks simpler. So we have divergence of E. So divergence of E. Do I still have the equations here? Or I just deleted them. I do. So divergence of E is divergence of minus gradient of phi minus dA over dt is equal to 4 pi rho. Okay, that's how my equation 3 looks like. Very good. So now I have minus Laplace on phi, and then minus d over dt divergence of A equals to 4 pi rho. And then why I chose my Lorentz gauge condition was that divergence of A is minus d phi over dt. Okay, so if I apply now the Lorentz gauge, so this thing is minus d phi over dt from the Lorentz gauge condition. And beauty of this is that you have Laplace, and then you have d phi square over dt square. So in other words, box on phi is minus 4 pi rho. You get a wave equation with a non-trivial right-hand side. Okay, so that's great. So 3 is done. It just turns to a wave equation because we use the Lorentz gauge condition. So now let's finally do equation 1. So now 1. Okay, so curl of B. So curl of B, but B is curl of A. And then minus d over dt of E, but E is this thing, so it's minus gradient of phi minus dA over dt equals to 4 pi j. All right, so that's what the equation 1 is. So now we have to use again this stupid identity here. So curl of curl is gradient of divergence of V. So this is gradient of divergence of A minus Laplace A. And then we have that. And then let's try to group some terms together. So we have minus Laplace on A, which is this term here. And then we have plus dA square over dt square, d square A dt square is that term here. And then we have plus gradient and then divergence of A. And then we have plus gradient d phi over dt equals to 4 pi j. Everybody happy? And so if you look at this thing here, and if you look at your Lorentz gauge condition, which we imposed anyway, you see that this is 0. Lorentz gauge condition again. And so we arrived that the equation 1 is actually now equivalent to, again, wave equation. So we have box on A is minus 4 pi j. So now we have another wave equation, this time for the vector potential A, and the source is through the current. Okay, so we just turned equation 3 and 1 into something much nicer, which are just the wave equations. But we use the Lorentz gauge condition. All right, So this seems as a simplification, and it indeed is a simplification. So now let's say, well, this equation is exactly the same as that equation. So if you can solve this equation, we can solve this one as well, right? They are just the same. I can treat this as a box acting on each component of the vector A, and then I have just three same equations as this one here. Okay, so now if I want to write down the general solution for phi, and you have this type of equation, do you know how it would look like?
Find the Green's function of the wave operator.
Uh-huh, very good. And so that gives me...
And then I don't remember, but then you convolute that.
Yeah. So we will do that. Perfect. So you have to find a special solution which solves this equation with the right hand side. Is this the most general solution of the wave equation?
Superposition. So a combination of the forward and the backward.
Okay. So it is. So superposition is good. That's the good word. So this is a linear equation, and so the solution of a linear equation with the right hand side is always given by a superposition of two solutions. Well, the most general solution of the homogeneous equation, where the right-hand side is zero, of course, that will be just waves running up and down, and then the special solution you were discussing. So the general solution is just solution of the homogeneous equation plus the special solution. Okay, so these will be just waves, and this will be something which is a special, so base, which is a solution of box on phi equals to zero. And then we will have a special solution solving this thing here, box on phi equals to minus 4 pi rho. And it's enough to find one solution here. Okay? So if you find one such solution that solves this equation, we just superpose it with any solution which solves the equation box on phi equals to zero. And that's our general solution. Okay, so this is, okay, if you have arbitrary differential operator, finding a solution of the homogeneous equation is extreme pain, and there's no procedure how to do it. In our case, it's just waves, so it's fine. However, to find the special solution, there's this beautiful technique through the Green's functions. So now let me just do it. Let's find the Green's function for our wave operator so that we can actually find this special solution here. And of course, the result will be the retarded potentials, as you know them from the electromagnetics course.
So without the gauge condition, we couldn't be able to solve these equations, right?
Like so exactly. So I still have an equation to solve, which is the gauge condition. Yeah. But it's only so nice if I am in this gauge. If I impose a different gauge, I will have extra terms here. And that will make it more difficult to solve. All right. So now the idea. So let's, special solution. To find a special solution, maybe better just write that. Okay. We want to find a special solution. Okay. And so we can use the method of Green's functions. And the statement is, I can just do it for phi. So I'll be finding phi as a function of r and t is the special phi, but I will not write, well, I could write this s here. And it's simply given as an integral over a Green's function, which is a function of r and t, r prime and t prime, and then you integrate over the right-hand side, 4 pi rho, r prime t prime, dr prime dt prime. Okay, so the statement is I can find the special solution in this form, where this g is called Green's function. It's called the Green's function. And of course, it has to be a special function. It's a function of rt and also the integration variables r prime and t prime. And okay, so g of r, t, r prime, and t prime. However, we are in empty space. Well, not really. But anyway, so we will be sort of in empty space. So we can impose the isotropy of the empty space, and we can impose the time translation invariance. So what actually can be shown is that this thing can depend only on the difference between r and r prime, in fact, on their magnitude, as we will see, of course, and then also on the difference between the two times, t and t prime. So you can think about it's like r prime and t prime are where the charges are and where they are, and then the field outside of this depends on somehow between the difference between r prime and r and t prime and t. All right, so we have this. Let's call this capital R, and let's call this capital T. So this will be a vector really here, but we shall see. Of course, it can only depend on the magnitude of that. And so then, which we as we know this, so the Green's function satisfies exactly the same equation as the phi, but now with a delta function on the right hand side. So now Dan discussed delta functions, right? Yesterday. So now you know everything about delta functions. And so we can use this. So the Green's function is simply a function which satisfies box on this is the right hand side is the delta function and delta t. If you want d3. Okay, so this is the definition of the Green's function. It can only depend on R and T, or capital R and capital T, because of the isotropy of the space. Okay, so let me show that this is indeed true, that what I'm writing here as phi special will indeed solve our equations. And it's a one-line proof, so that's why we can do it. So we claim the solution is given by this integral over the Green's function. And this solution better satisfy our equation, our wave equation, which we want. All right. So very good. So prove that this is the solution. Prove. Well, all we have to do is we have to apply box on our solution, box on phi. Okay, so box is something which acts on t and r. Okay, if you look at your integral, the only quantity which depends on t and r is the Green's function. Okay, because I'm evaluating rho at r prime and t prime, which are the dummy variables of integration. Okay, so this is just given by the integral of box of g, box on g. And then you have 4 pi rho and dr prime dt prime. So the box is in t and r only, so it only acts on the g. Okay? But our definition, this is just minus delta of r delta of t. Okay, so what it does is that basically if I integrate over dr prime and dt prime, the integral just uses this delta function and changes wherever I see r prime to r and wherever I see t prime to t. So this is minus 4 pi rho at r and t, which is precisely the equation which we want to solve. So if we can find such a Green function, then this thing here will be our solution. All right, so that's perfect. So now let's do it. So this will take some calculation to actually find what this Green's function is. Okay, let's go ahead. So let's find G. Okay, and that will take us probably half an hour. So the first step, again, Dan is great, so he probably discussed the Fourier analysis, did he? Or did he discuss the Fourier representation of delta function? Okay, you should know it anyway. If not, I'll just give you the result. Okay, so the step actually is to go to the Fourier space. So we transform, okay, so we have g as a function of r and t. Okay, and so let's transform, Fourier transform both r and t. Okay, so then we have an expression that g r and t is given by 1 over, I'm using the convention when the Fourier transform has 1 over 2 pi for each degree of freedom. And then you would have dk, d omega, which are the Fourier modes, g of k and omega, I k r minus I omega t. Everybody's seen this. Who hasn't seen Fourier transform? Okay, that's great. So this is super simple. I'm just writing how my position space Green's function looks like in terms of the Fourier space Green's function. So now you want to apply the box operator, and you require that this is equal to minus delta delta. Okay, so let's apply the box operator on this. Okay, but box operator acts on this r and t. Okay, it goes through the integral of k and omega. It goes through this function which depends on k and omega. And the only thing which depends on r and t is this exponential. So it goes all the way here. Okay. So now what is this box? Well, box operator is just you differentiate twice with respect to time, and you differentiate twice with respect to r. Okay, so that's super simple because we just have an exponential. So differentiating twice with respect to r brings me k square, and in differentiating twice with respect to time gives me omega square. Okay, so what this thing here actually is nothing else than, and there's some I, so there's some signs, omega square minus k vector square, and then you still have the exponential k times r minus I omega t. Okay, just differentiating twice the exponential. All right, so now this better be equal to minus delta r delta t. Okay, so now there is the step missing that you need to know the Fourier representation of the delta function. But the truth is that it's just if you take one here. So you know that Fourier transformation takes, okay, so if you have really peaked something in the X space, it's really spread out in the K space. So if you have a delta function, it's the narrowest thing as possible. It's really the thing here. So then the Fourier mode of that is just one everywhere. Okay, simply completely spread out, just constant one. Okay, so this thing here is just minus 1 over 2 pi to the 4. I'm writing this dk d omega e to I k times r minus I omega t. So this is the Fourier representation of the delta function. So it's just one times the exponential. Very good. So now these better be equal, right? So on the left hand side, we have gk omega, omega square minus k square exponential. And this better be equal to 1. So from here, we are getting that gk omega times omega square minus k square is equal to actually minus 1 because there's an overall minus sign, minus 1. And so we know how the Fourier form of our Green's function looks like. So from here, we conclude that gk omega is just minus 1. Oh, I can swap these things here, k square minus omega square. So perfect. So we know how g looks like in the Fourier space. Everybody happy so far? All right, so now the painful step is to really go from the Fourier space back to the X space. That's what we need. We need g as a function of r and t, right? So we have to go back. Of course, this is the formula. right? So the formula is just without the box, it's just g equals to without the box, this thing here. Okay, so then we have that, so back to position space, position slash time space. So we have that g of r and t. Okay, so it's 1 over 2 pi 4. Okay, so then it will be an integral over dk and d omega. So now the trick is to use, so whatever, so you see that you have this exponential k times r here. So I can always choose coordinates in my k space so that r is in the z direction. Okay, so what I'm saying is that you can choose, so you need to integrate over k space coordinates. So you can choose coordinates that r is this way and k is that way, and there is an angle theta in between them. And so I'm placing r in the z direction, and then I'll be using spherical coordinates in my k space. Okay? So what I'm trying to say here is k times r is just the magnitude of k times r times cosine theta in between them. And I'll be saying that I can write integral of d3k as integral in the spherical coordinates. So it will be integral of k squared dk, d phi, and d cosine theta. Okay, so d omega. So then I write this thing here as k squared dk, where this is really the magnitude in these coordinates, and then d phi in the k space, and d cosine theta in the k space. And then we have the function g. But of course, k vector square is just the magnitude of the vector. So it's just k square. It's just k square minus omega square. And then the exponential is I k times r magnitude times cosine theta, and then minus I omega t. Did I forget anything? Maybe. Everybody happy with this? So this is in spherical coordinates. Spherical coordinates. All right, so that's what it is, and it's really a useful trick to go to these spherical coordinates. So now, of course, nothing depends on phi. So phi runs from 0 to 2 pi. So the integration over d phi, it just gives us 2 pi. Okay? So then the next step is to do the integration over theta. Okay, so if I do integration over d cosine theta, I go from minus 1 to 1, or like that. Okay? And then I have cosine theta only here. So what it means is basically I have to integrate the exponential, which is super easy. It just gives me one, the same exponential, but over 1 over I kr. Okay, so I just bring that down. And then I just plug plus 1 or minus 1. Okay, so very good. So after the integration over phi and cosine theta, I get, so this integration over phi kills 1 over these things. So it's 2 pi cube. That comes from integration over phi. And I have still integral d omega dk. Then I have k square. And I have 1 over k square minus omega square.
David?
Yeah?
In the question, you have d cosine theta. It is d theta cosine theta. In the second equation.
It's d theta. Cosine theta. It's just the volume element on the sphere, right? So it's sine theta d theta. Or something like that. Yeah. All right. So now this thing here, as I'm saying, is just cosine theta. It's plus 1 or minus 1. So this will be e to minus I omega t, and then I will have e to I k r minus e to minus I k r, which is just plus, plugging here plus one or minus one. But of course, if I integrate this, I also bring to the bottom I k r is at the bottom. Everybody happy so far? More or less. Unless there are some stupid mistakes, it should be fine. All right. So now I can simplify my life a little bit. So I have k square here, and I have k here. So I can cancel one k. So I'll have just that. And of course, r is just a constant, so I can bring it outside. So in other words, you can write this as 1 over 2 pi cube 1 over ir, and then an integral from minus infinity to infinity d omega e minus I omega t, and then you just write an integral, which is the integral, remaining integral over k space. So why I'm doing this painful calculation is that we would have to do it in relativity anyway. And so it's just easier to do it now. And then we can just refer to the result in the relativity course.
What happened to, why did we pull out an r from the integral?
So r is just a, you know, it's constant. It's not, it doesn't depend on k or omega, right? So r is just the distance.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. And so what I define is I here is an integral. So now if you go to the spherical coordinates, of course, the magnitude of k can only go from 0 to infinity. Right? It's the radius, right? So it goes from 0 to infinity. So that's why this integral I is just an integral from 0 to infinity. And then I'm plugging everything, what is remaining there. It's I k r minus I k r divided by k square minus omega square k dk. Okay, so that's what was left over there. And the trick is that if you look at, so we have to integrate two terms, but they are basically the same, except that one, so I can write this, is it an even or odd function, one of those. So you can write this as an integral from minus infinity to infinity of one of them. So k times a kr over k square minus omega square dk. Okay, so this is what it is, because it's an even function or whatever, odd function, some function. All right, so of course, this is a bloody complex integral, right? And moreover, this integral doesn't make any sense because you integrate over a real line of k, but of course, there is poles, right? So k equal to plus minus omega actually, you know, gives you a problem. So this integral is not really well defined, but the principal value of the integral is well defined. Okay, so what we want to integrate over, so we have the k complex plane. Okay, and so this will be the real number, real of k. And what we really want to do is that we want to integrate along this axis. This is the imaginary of k. So we want to integrate along this line here, but we have two poles. We have a pole at k equal to minus omega, and we have another pole at k equals to plus omega. Okay? And so when we integrate these things, we cannot go through the poles, so we have to go around them. Okay? So let's go, and it doesn't matter which way you go around them. So we integrate from minus infinity, so we start here, and then of course, if you go through the pole, it's infinity. But let's go around the pole. And we keep going and go around the pole and keep going. OK. And so what we want to use, of course, is the residual theorem to calculate what this is. OK. So then you know that you have to circle around something in the complex plane, and then the integral equals to the sum of residua inside. So in this case, we want to calculate something which is IKR, where R is the magnitude of the distance between R and R prime. So R is positive. And so there is some bloody lemma telling you that if R is positive, I have to close the contour in the upper half. So this is the way to close the contour of integration. And so then we have lots of integrals. So we have the integral along the real axis, which is the one which we want. So that's the integral I. Okay. So then we have the integral along this thing here, which is I tilde. And then we have to circle around the poles. And so we have I1 and then I2. Okay. So now, if you go around this thing here, taking into account the orientation I just draw, then we have that integral I plus integral I tilde. But, you know, I'm going around the poles in the opposite direction. So it's minus I1 minus I2 equals to sum. So it's 2 pi I times sum of the residua inside. Sum of the residua. But if you look at this thing here, whatever we circled around, are there any poles? Are there any problems? There are no poles. So this is actually equal to zero. So there are no residua, no poles inside. So we just, you know, close the contour in such a way that all the poles are outside. Very good. So now, as I said, R is bigger than zero. This is the form of the function. There is a bloody lemma called Jordan's lemma. Jordan's lemma, which tells you that basically, of course, this closure is at infinity, but at infinity this goes like 1 over k. So that's actually sufficiently enough so that this integral doesn't contribute. So I tilde, the integral over I tilde goes to 0 through to this Jordan's lemma. Okay, and so then we have that our integral I, which we are interested in, it's just the integral along the real line, is just some of the integrals I1 and I2. Okay, so all we need to do is actually go around the poles, and that's what gives us our integral. So going around the poles, another lemma, I don't know what it is, but basically it tells you, you know, how much angle you sweep. In our case, we go from here to there, so it's an angle pi. So it's I pi. Okay, and then it's the residuum in this pole and the residuum in that pole. So residuum in minus omega plus the residuum. Okay, so it's residuum of the function f at minus omega plus the residuum of function f at plus omega. So you need to know how to calculate the residua. We cannot escape that. Okay? But our function is such that, you know, the poles in k equals to plus minus omega are simple poles. Okay, there's only one pole. It's not like 1 over k square, where the zero would be a double pole there. This is just a simple pole. And so then you can calculate these things is that you take your function f, which is this function here, and you just multiply by the corresponding problem. So if you want to calculate, let's say, a residuum at k equal to plus omega, then I just multiply this by k minus omega, which kills the problem, and take the limit k goes to omega. Okay, so what you need to do here is you take f, you multiply it by k minus omega, and you take the limit k goes to omega. Okay, so that's how you calculate this thing here. So let's see what it is. So it's k times e kr divided by k minus omega times k plus omega. Now I multiply by k minus omega and take the limit k goes to omega. So this thing kills the problem. And now I take k goes to omega, which is e to I omega r divided by 2. So if you haven't taken any complex analysis, just don't worry about it, just believe me. Okay? So similarly, you can do for the residuum at minus omega. And the only difference is that now you will have minus omega here. Okay, so the integral here is just I pi over 2 ei omega r plus e minus I omega r.
I want to ask if, like, if you go below the residuum, like, would it be a difference?
Do it. What do you think? Is it different? Of course, if I circle around like this thing here, right? Let's say I go this way. Of course, now my residual theorem picks this pole here because now it's inside the integration. But then I go in this direction around the pole. Okay. So maybe
there will be no pole.
Sorry? You still have to go around the pole, right. but now I'm going, you know, the way downwards.
Yeah.
Right? So that will change this value of I1, right? It will change the value of I1. But now the whole thing actually contains a pole inside. So my residual theorem here won't be zero anymore, but will pick up the residuum here. Okay? So either it is the same or not. Up to you to show that it's the same. It doesn't matter how you circle around the pole.
In the quantum field theory,
uh-huh,
the Feynman propagators, it really depends on, like...
Exactly. But there, you integrate over something else. Here, we integrate over the k-space. If you do the integration in the quantum field theory, it should be integral over the zero, over the frequency space. Okay. Let's have the discussion maybe in tutorial. I think it's fine. But we will see that whatever I'm claiming to you is actually doesn't make any sense whatsoever anyway. Okay, so I'm claiming it doesn't matter which way you go. If you convince me otherwise, I'll be very happy. Okay. So anyway, so we have now the result. So the result is, where is the result? So we have that g of r and t is equal to 1 over 2 pi cube, 2 pi cube, and then 1 over ir, integral from minus infinity to infinity d omega. And then we have I pi half from there. Okay, let's put I pi and half here. And then it's e to minus I omega t plus I omega r plus e to minus I omega t minus I omega r. Okay, so this can be simplified to be 1 over 16 pi square r, and then we have minus infinity to infinity d omega, and then e minus I omega t plus r plus e minus I omega t minus r. Okay, that's what it is. And now if you look at this thing here, you have an integral, which is like the Fourier integral, over an exponential only. Okay, so then what is that? You just learned a couple of minutes ago. It's what? It's the delta function, right? So we just integrate 1 over some exponential, and it's a delta function of whatever stands here. So this thing here can be written as 1 over, so of course I have to consume 1 over 2 pi there. So it's 1 over 8 pi r. That's what remains there. And it's simply delta function r plus t plus delta function t minus r or it's even, so it doesn't matter, R minus T. All right, so we have found the Green's function, and it's simply given by two delta functions. But these delta functions depend on R, the distance between the things, but the magnitude of that, and the distance between the times. So what it actually tells you, and of course the C, the propagation speed, is C is equal to 1. So what really stands here is R plus CT and R minus CT. So what this really tells you is that basically the Green's function is only non-trivial on the light cone. Okay, so it's only non-trivial on light cone. So a non-trivial trivial on light cone. And so that of course tells you again that the waves actually propagate at the speed of light. All right, but we have some interesting thing here is that, you know, if we have R minus T, let's set T prime and R prime equal to 0. So this is really R minus T, small r minus small t. So it tells you, well, if I start propagating from the origin at time equal to T0 to some distance R and T, well, I will reach the distance after elapsing some time T. Okay, so that's fine. So it takes some time for the signal to travel there. So this is the standard retarded potential or retarded propagation as you know it. On the other hand, here, you see that if I go to a distance R, I reach there at time equals to minus R. Okay, so this is an advanced propagation. So maybe it's fault of my integration contour, let's discuss in tutorial. But here I'm getting actually both types of potentials. I'm getting advanced potentials and I'm getting also the retarded potentials. And they are simply there. They are the solution of the Green's function. Of course, people don't like advanced advanced potentials because basically, you know, the signal arrives earlier than actually the charge does something. Right, and that seems very weird. It seems to violate causality. And so people simply do is that they argue that by physics, this cannot happen. Okay? And in order to get the right result, so we had plus plus, one result plus another result. So it's like two results. But we get rid of one of them. Okay? So then they say, well, I just replace it. I take twice this one. Okay, so then this one goes to 1 over 4 pi r if I take delta r minus t. Okay, so that's what people do. And so maybe, I don't know. So they just throw away half of the physics, right? They throw away half of the solutions, the advanced solutions. And then they say, well, to amend for that, I just take the other solution twice. Okay, so that's, I don't know. So the only person who doesn't do that is Feynman and Wheeler. And that was the origin of Feynman-Wheeler's theory, where they actually take both. They take advanced and retarded potentials equally, because they are given to you by these equations. Okay? But then they have to deal with causality, and they have to deal with, you know, advanced potentials. But they actually did deal with them, and they have classically complete theory of electromagnetism, which agrees with experiment, which uses both advanced and retarded potentials. But in classical electromagnetism, you just take the retarded ones. Okay, so let me just write with all the glory the solution which we found. So we have the Green's function in terms of the retarded potentials because we don't like the advanced ones. And the result is simply given by the integral over this retarded function.
But the I don't get it in the sense that suppose that the difference between a retarded and an advanced Green's function is a solution of the homogeneous wave equation, right? So it shouldn't make any difference which one you choose. Maybe it's not as easily interpretable, whatever homogeneous solution you have to add, but but they both should be at least mathematically equivalent, right? I mean, you can use whichever one you want. We would have gotten only the retarded part if we had chosen a different modification of the contour.
I don't think so. Okay, let's discuss this. I would really like to settle this once and forever, but I don't think so. I think, you know, no matter how you close the contour, this is what you get, I think. But you know, let's try to investigate this. That'll be really nice. So anyway, so this is that. And so we have the formula 4 pi rho with r prime t prime dr prime dt prime. So that was the formula. So now we know that g is just 1 over 4 pi r delta r minus t. And so what this is an integral over delta. So r was r minus r prime minus t prime divided by 4 pi r is r minus r prime. And then 4 pi rho r prime t prime dr prime dt prime. Okay, so this is what it is. And so now you can do some integration over something. So this is a nice symmetric formula, but it still has the integration over space and time. And you will use it tomorrow to show something. But okay, the 4 pi cancels, of course. But it's also possible to, for example, integrate over time. And so then you get the nice formula, which is just an integral over space. So you have dr prime. And then we just evaluate this rho at r prime. But now t prime becomes, just using this delta function, is just t minus r prime. So at t minus r prime, and divided by r minus r prime. And that's it. And so this is what is called a retarded potential, because basically you take the charge density at a retarded time. You take it at the time you want, but minus, you have to propagate there. So it's r minus r prime. And so this solution really takes into account the finite speed of propagation of signal. And of course, you have exactly the same solution for the vector potential, but now there will be j here. That's the only difference. All right, so we gloriously arrive at retarded potentials. You can argue that equally you can have advanced potentials as well if you take the other part of the delta function. So please go through this derivation again. Tell me if I'm doing something wrong. Tell me if I can get only one of the potentials just from doing mass. From doing physics, by doing physics, I just cross the advanced potentials. I say I don't want them because they violate causality. But just doing mass properly, can we actually arrive at one solution or another? Please tell me. Questions? OK, happy times.